Welcome to On the Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and big bickies. On the Money is coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. On the Money, the buck stops with us. I'm your host, Catherine Zangerer. This week, the housing affordability issue isn't going away anytime soon. Treasurer Joe Hockey's remarks that the only way into housing is to get a better job seem to open a can of worms. Inside, issues like foreign investment, housing bubbles, and negative gearing all up for debate. We'll delve into those issues with the Real Estate Institute, National Shelter, and the China Relations Institute. Also, what happens when you're starting a small business but your supplier disappears with both your goods and your money? Well, if your business is a microbrewery, you throw on a few kegs and invite your mates to raise the dosh. That's all coming up. You're on the money. The government's attempted win on foreign investment rules turned to disaster when Treasurer Joe Hockey said this.
If housing were unaffordable in Sydney, no one would be buying it. The starting point for a first home buyer is to get a good job that pays good money. If you've got a good job and pays good money and you have security in relation to that job, then you can go to the bank and you can borrow money.
His comment opened a can of worms on the issue of housing affordability, prompting the Executive Officer of National Shelter, Adrian Pazarsky, to say this.
Well, I think in the first place, Mr. Hockey has to understand just how expensive housing is and who's actually buying it. We've seen complaints from all sorts of sources that it is investors, by and large, that are buying property rather than owner-occupiers. So I think he misunderstands the pattern of the market. And I think he also misunderstands the sort of income that you actually need to sustain the housing repayments, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. Not everybody can have a job that supports the level of repayments required for million-dollar houses.
Do you think that Joe Hockey, in saying those comments, was just indicating, in a way, a reluctance for the government to actually step in as they've been pressured to by, for example, the Greens in terms of addressing issues like negative gearing?
I think the point is that the government is already in there through its current policy settings, which are distorting the market. And having a look at the settings for negative gearing and capital gains tax exemptions is actually just sensible policy. Why wouldn't you want to look at those levers that you do have control of to see if you can make a difference?
Executive Officer with National Shelter, Adrian Pazarsky. The debate saw Treasury Secretary John Fraser put forward his view that Sydney was in a housing bubble, and with the rate of home ownership in the prime 25 to 34-year age group dropping 21% from 56% in 1982 to only 34% in 2011, there's no doubt there are plenty of people who'd love to get into the property market who can't. There's a big push to deal with the issues of negative gearing and capital gains tax discounts, which the Australia Institute estimates costs the government $7.7 billion a year. It's also an issue which the Henry Tax Review wanted to see addressed. They put forward a model for some moderate changes to negative gearing arrangements, but any changes are strongly opposed by the Real Estate Institute of Australia. I caught up with President Neville Sanders. When economists modelled the impacts of those changes in the Henry Tax Review on rental property, they found that a modest reform would increase investment in rental housing and reduce rents by an average of $300 a year. So that goes against that myth that's out there that if you abolished negative gearing, the rental market would spike, wouldn't it?
There's a number of facets to negative gearing. Firstly, the ability of business investors, whether it be buying shares or business activity, to offset the costs is a normal function of our tax system. The distortion is not negative gearing in real estate. If that was to be isolated or limited, that would in fact be a distortion of our tax system because it applies to all classes of investment, not just to real estate. The connotation that this is a special treatment, of course, is the first premise that's incorrect. The second part of it is that governments may be foregoing some income, but at the same time, the private rental market is supplying housing that's desirable by renters, and they take that responsibility away from government and allow the private sector to provide housing. So governments have recognised that whilst they might be foregoing some income, at the same time, they don't have to pour huge amounts of public money into public housing.
But the private sector hasn't been doing that well in providing that rental market, providing that housing, has it? Because we know that rental vacancies are really low, and that's right across Australia.
And I think that comes back to the overall shortage of supply across the board, whether it be owner-occupied or for investment purposes. Australia is simply not creating enough new housing to satisfy the growth in our population and the following demand.
Is there any actual evidence that negative gearing increases supply of new homes? Because in June 2013, only 5% of housing investment loans went toward the construction of new dwellings. So we're not seeing that many new dwellings being built. So we've had those negative gearing rules in place for a long time.
They have been enforced for a long period. I guess the way I would focus it is that people buy investment properties in areas where the demand is, and that's often established property. So it's not always going to be a focus of an investor, I need to buy a new property or build a new property or buy a new apartment or a new home for investment purposes. So most investors will buy real estate in an area where they feel the demand is strong enough that they'll have good occupancy rates. So they're motivated by other reasons. But what it does do, it adds to the housing stock overall because it provides homes for those that need it, and market forces dictate the rent levels, and supply in general, of course, is the number one problem, whether it be an owner-occupier or a tenant looking for property. It's the inadequate supply that's creating most of the pressure in most of the Australian markets.
Do you think that the pressure on the government to address this issue of negative gearing means that at some point it's inevitable that the government is going to have to face up to it and deal with it, and therefore the property market is going to have to find a way of responding to that?
I don't believe this current government will do it. They've made a strong commitment that they will not do it, both publicly and via the last opportunity in the budget was considered and then ruled out in the most recent budget. Prime Minister Abbott has provided advice privately to the Real Estate Institute of Victoria just last week and confirmed, and he was happy to be quoted, that they are not considering the abolition of negative gearing as it relates to real estate.
What would your advice be, given that Joe Hockey said that the best way for a person to get into the housing market is to just get a better paying job? What would your advice be to people who are trying to buy their own home, given that we've seen figures fall of home ownership in the 25 to 34 age bracket drop by 20% since 1982?
Look, there are a number of reasons for that. Some of them will be financial, some of them will be people staying in education longer, and so they're coming out into the workforce at an older age. They're also travelling, and they've got different priorities than the generation of two or three decades ago. So there's a whole range of reasons why home ownership in that younger age bracket has declined. What Joe Hockey, when I read his full quote, he was driving at was, in order to qualify for a loan and to borrow funds, you need a good job. So everyone should strive to have not necessarily a high-paying job, but a job that fits their skill set and their education level and become eligible for loans. And one of the things we must also recognise is that a lot of people desire to live in the inner parts of our cities, and Sydney's a prime example. But when it comes to what they can afford to buy, they can't afford to buy in that location. So they may really be required to move out further. And there are properties in lower price bands than the median. The median house price in Sydney is around $750,000. But that's just simply a number in the middle. There are a lot of properties above, and there are also a lot of properties below. But you do have to go out from what are the most desirable suburbs, and that's the compromise, especially for the first home buyer.
On the Money. Ride the gravy train with us.
You're on the Money with me, Catherine Zengerer. The government has also been trying to play down the issue of whether foreign investment in the real estate market has been playing a factor in pushing prices up. They've tightened the rules around accessing the market, and in December will be introducing fines for those to have breached the rules of $127,500, or 3 years in prison for an individual, and $637,500 for a company. Real estate professionals found to be assisting foreign investors to breach the rules can also be fined. It's a move the Real Estate Institute's Neville Sanders welcomes.
The REIA supports the crackdown for those that have not been eligible, that have actually made purchases. But at this early stage, the numbers don't indicate that it has had any significant effect on the marketplace.
What's the reason for that?
I think the main issues in the marketplace regarding high prices really are related to a low cost of money, but more importantly, a shortage of supply. So demand is exceeding supply. Sydney, of course, is the hottest and strongest market at the moment, but it's not so in a lot of the other capital cities around Australia, where the market is much more subdued.
In relation to the housing prices in Sydney, we've seen the Treasury Secretary, John Fraser, this week say that there is, in fact, a housing bubble in Sydney. This is something that the government has been keen to deny. Is it your view that there is a housing bubble in Sydney?
No, and when we speak to real estate agents that are practising in Sydney, they don't believe it's a bubble. They believe that, again, it's a shortage of supply and there's strong demand. And until supply increases, and in inner Sydney, that is fairly unlikely, you're not going to see a significant change, because a bubble implies that it's overpriced and it will burst at some point. We don't agree with that view.
So does that mean you think that Sydney prices will stay high?
Well, yes, and whilst you do get some periods where prices can even out a little, a bubble bursting is a totally different event, and I think the circumstances of previous property corrections, for example, in the early 90s when we had a severe recession, the circumstances that prevailed then are totally different to what prevail today. Banks, lending criteria is a little sounder now. The cost of money is modest, so that if property owners find themselves in financial difficulty, a lot of those owners simply sell their property and they don't sustain losses. So they have that opportunity to move out of the market if they need to.
When the government's Parliamentary Standing Committee on Economics had a look into the issue of foreign investment and into housing affordability, what they found is that if they put measures in place to reduce foreign investment, measures like those that have been put in place in other places in the world like Singapore and Hong Kong, where they, for example, put a 15% stamp duty on foreign investment, they found that if they did that, it would actually have the effect of actually providing a disincentive for foreign investment, and that that would in fact in turn have an effect on domestic prices. So doesn't that imply therefore that foreign investment actually does interact with housing prices in the domestic market?
I think it does, but that's probably only really related to new stock, so new construction, because that's where the volume is. So the established market is where a lot of the publicity is around discussion points of high prices. It's mostly in the established market. But the measures we've been speaking of predominantly apply to new construction. And I don't think the distinction is often spoken of or highlighted adequately.
There's no real incentive for the government to want to actually bring prices down on new housing, is there? Because if they did take a measure, for example, by limiting foreign investment in new housing, that would actually reduce the tax base in things like capital gains, GST, and also stamp duty revenue for state and territory governments. So there's not really much of an incentive there, is there, for governments to bring in measures that bring prices down in that new housing market?
No, I agree with that summary. And in addition to that, it might have an unexpected effect on construction and the housing industry. The housing construction industry is the most significant contributor to the Australian economy, and anything that slowed construction rates and that sector of the market would not be desirable either.
In terms of the housing affordability issue, what the Treasurer, Joe Hockey, has said is that the main issue is the lack of supply. What do you see as the roadblocks to that lack of supply?
Well, predominantly it's availability of land and or developmental sites and permits. So the process of supplying services to new land subdivisions, and typically they are in the major cities on the fringe of those areas further out, and providing services is quite difficult. That's why all state governments are, to some degree, supporting infill development, whether it be small, middle-sized developments of apartments and units, and, of course, then at the higher end, the large-scale high-rise apartments, utilising the existing infrastructure and bolstering it as opposed to creating a whole new set of infrastructure in new suburbs. But certainly supply, which the government has a significant control lever, that's where a lot of the problems have always been.
President of the Real Estate Institute, Neville Sanders.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
The concern over foreign investment has been piqued by the forced sale of a Sydney mansion worth $39 million after it was illegally purchased by a Chinese company. Chinese investors spend $66 billion in the Australian real estate market, but Deputy Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute, James Lawrenson, says the focus on China is misguided.
Chinese investors have been active in Australia's real estate market, but then again, so have investors from other countries. I noticed Joe Hockey's comments today. He particularly mentioned a UK buyer that had come forward and admitted that they'd probably broken the rules.
There was a Credit Suisse report that came out showing that 18% of new homes in Sydney and 14% of new homes in Melbourne in the 13-14 financial year were being bought by Chinese buyers, and that investment was expected to be in the range of $44 billion in the years up to 2020. That's a pretty hefty investment, isn't it? How could that not be contributing to the housing prices?
It is a hefty investment, and those Credit Suisse numbers were bigger than any other numbers we've seen before. And one of the good reasons for that is because the Credit Suisse actually included purchases by Chinese immigrants. In other words, by Australian citizens and Australian permanent residents. So it's not surprising that if you put that group together with real Chinese investors, that is those actually living in mainland China, that the numbers appear very big. Also, they talked about the share of Chinese buyers compared with new housing supply. Well, new housing is exactly what Australia's foreign investment rules encourage foreigners to buy. So the report wasn't that surprising in the end.
Because they want that foreign investment to actually stimulate the supply side of the market.
Yeah, so it stimulates supply in two ways. One, developers need funds to get the buildings up in the first place. If people aren't buying the apartments, they're not going to be able to go to the bank to get funding to get the building up in place. And the second reason, of course, is that they're buying new properties. Now, housing's just an asset, so we all buy and sell assets. So if a Chinese buyer, for example, bought a new house and then after 5 years sold it, they have to sell it to an Australian citizen or permanent resident because that's the rules. So it increases the supply in the secondary market.
In your opinion, do you think we've got the balance right in terms of these foreign investment rules about monitoring how much investors, like investors from China, can invest into the housing market in Australia or the real estate market in Australia, not just housing, and the issue of housing affordability?
Yeah, I do think we have the balance right. I mean, the rules say that we want foreign investment in new housing. So that's where we want to concentrate our efforts. If we can have some enforcement that encourages that to happen even more so than it is now, that's a good thing. Now, affordability is affected by a lot of things. And for me, as an economist, the big thing that's changed over the last couple of years is not a jump in the share of foreign buyers, it's falling interest rates. You can borrow very cheaply now. And for me, that's the most obvious thing to be looking at as to why housing prices have been going up so quickly.
So is it really only then an impression or anecdotal evidence that the big investment in apartment development, for example, which we're seeing in Sydney and Melbourne and other capitals as well, where there is a really big upfront investment required,
yep,
is coming from the Chinese?
Well, if you believe the Foreign Investment Review Board, and they say, no, that's not the case. So they're the ones who are saying that less than one in five foreign investment dollars into real estate is coming from China. So again, they are the biggest single group, no doubt about that, but still compared with the rest of the world, it's less than one in five.
Why do you think Australia seems to be so worried about Chinese investment if you say that Chinese investment is only, or one out of five of foreign investors are Chinese investors? Why do you think we feel so worried about that?
Well, first of all, housing prices are a problem. So I'm not surprised at all that people are very sensitive about house prices, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. It's a problem. I'm renting. House prices are out of my price range, and so I can imagine that there's a lot of people doing it a lot tougher than I am. So it's a problem. Why Chinese in particular? Look, I think the rise of China in Australia's economic consciousness has been very recent and rapid. This sort of thing happened with the Japanese 30 years ago. Nowadays, I think most people are quite comfortable with Japanese investment. But Chinese investment is a new thing, so I think it takes a while to get used to.
Deputy Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute, James Lawrenson.
On the Money. In for a podcast, in for a pound.
You're on The Money with me, Catherine Zangerer. And hello if you're listening to us in Sydney on 2SER Radio. When you're starting up a small business, what do you do first? You check out the competition. And we all know competition is fierce, and getting a business idea off the ground is hard work. That work can be made even harder when you've invested thousands of dollars in a supplier who goes bust. That's what happened to a small microbrewery in Sydney whose startup was brought to a screeching halt when their supplier failed to deliver after taking their money. So for the owners of Shark Island Brewery, the last thing they expected was for their competition to step in and lend them a hand. Tanya Katsanis reports.
Shark Island Brewery business partners and mates, James Peebles and Dion Dreiser Dickinson, thought their dream of starting their own brewery was over when all their brewery equipment failed to turn up. When they chased the supplier, who they'd already paid, no one returned their calls. Digging a little deeper, they found out via Facebook they weren't the only ones. Fast forward to June, 8 months after they were supposed to launch their product, and were instead here at a fundraiser at the Royal Albert Hotel in Sydney's Surry Hills. The fundraiser was the brainchild of licensee Michael Bain.
Dreiser is one of the owners of Shark Island. He's been drinking here for a long time. And obviously when I heard what had happened with the BrewCorp debacle with the guys losing their deposit, I thought nothing better than he supported me for a long time, so obviously we thought we'd support Shark Island and try and raise some money for them to get them back on the road.
And what do you hope to achieve from tonight's event?
Well, hopefully we can raise $5,000. I want to hit the $5,000 mark for the boys and so they can get back up and brewing at their new premises.
Michael wasn't the only supporter. Other small breweries came to the party donating kegs of beer for the cause. Lance Cochran of Black Rock Brewery lent the Shark Island crew the use of his facilities to brew their first batch, especially for the night. Shark Island Brewery business partner James Peebles says without the help of the industry and people like Lance, their boutique brewery business would be dead in the water.
It's the right industry to be in because everyone is a close-knit community, and they once one person's stung, they feel like they've been stung as well. So it's about supporting each other to make sure that everyone supports the craft beer industry so we can push that forward.
A number of microbreweries got together on the 2nd of May to produce a collaborative brew. What do you think was the highlight of that day?
Just to get to know brewers that we hadn't known before, and just the camaraderie out of it to help promote, like I said, craft beer again, and just to make sure that we get our money back as well.
Family and friends, as well as other small brewers who've also been financially affected by the loss of the supplier, are here to show their support.
I'm here to try their beers and see what they have on tap.
I'm here because I enjoy local craft beers, and to hear somebody down in their luck, who is an Australian craft beer brewer, I'm willing to help them out.
I'm here to help Dreiser and basically help the guys get off the road.
Yeah, we heard the bad deal they got, and like Dreiser, I thought,
every brewery needs help to get going in Sydney.
Because they're a locally run brewery.
I'm a partner, so...
Why am I here? I like to see some different beers with a bit of flavour back on the market rather than the sort of the mass-produced stuff that comes around. So tasting a little Kolsch tonight, it's very fruity, very nice, and very easy to drink. So.
Well, I'm his brother-in-law, so you know, there's a family connection there, so I like, you know, we've got to support the family.
So we've got a pretty happy crowd here because they're supporting a cause they believe in and getting to taste some local craft beers. It's exactly what the Royal Albert Hotel's Michael Bain was hoping for.
We've got 10 different breweries that have donated stock for Shark Island, so it's not even really about competition. It's about growing the industry and getting people that don't drink craft beer into drinking craft beer and Australian-owned craft beer.
For Shark Island Brew business partner James Peebles, he hopes people are getting more than a nice beer.
Just awareness of what happened more than anything else, awareness of our brand as well, and maybe added bonus of having a bit of cash flow to help us start up as well for the money we lost.
If you didn't get the support from the industry that you're currently getting, where do you think Shark Island Brewery would be today?
Probably wouldn't be around now. Thank goodness for Black Rock in Sylvania. They've given us a chance to brew some stuff. If they didn't come on board, we'd be struggling to know what to do at the moment. Our heads would be falling out everywhere, pretty much.
Publican Michael Bain says he'll do it all again if there was a need.
Hopefully I don't have to for the same cause, for obvious reasons, like you don't want anyone to go through that. But if it ever happened again, I'd be more than happy to support local breweries and obviously local craft beers, absolutely.
So, what lies ahead for Shark Island Brewery? Now they've had this helping hand from the industry, here's James Peebles.
We've got our first beer out today and we've got brewed another one this week, so it should be out in middle of June sometime, and our actual tasting bar area should be in about 3 months time.
Tanya Katsanis reporting from the Royal Albert Hotel in Surry Hills.
On the money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
That's it for On The Money this week. Thanks to our reporter Tanya Katsanis. You can find all our podcasts at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser. And please like us on Facebook. You can have your say on any of our stories when we post them on Facebook every week. I'm Catherine Zengara. Thanks for your company.